Well, first thing, I think one of the things is like I was in Lisburn and I remember doing a race in one of the parks and winning the race. I remember that. And I was probably about 3 or 4 years old. So,
Unbelievable. I'm born and
yeah.
bred Lisburn, so it was probably Wallace Park or something like
It probably was Wallace
that.
Park, yeah.
Well, look, hello and welcome to Best of Belfast, the podcast that celebrates Northern Ireland and the incredible people in it. We've already been hearing today from Adrian Balfour, who's the founder of Invorso, which is a US consultant firm based in Seattle, who's worked with the likes of Ford and Microsoft. As we'll get into, he's also an organic sheep farmer, an angel investor, co-founder of Major League Rugby, owner of the Seattle Seawolves, a US rugby team coached by Alan Clark, and the one and only Rory Best. Previously, he created P-Cubed, which is a project management consultancy that he grew to 1,000 consultants before selling it in 2013. So lots and lots of really interesting, fertile ground to cover today in lots of different kind of arenas and spheres of life. Today's episode is part of our ongoing series with NI Connections, where we share the stories of incredible Northern Irish people living and working overseas. Big thanks to them for connecting us with Adrian today. And you can head over to their website, niconnections.com, which is where you can also sign up for their free monthly newsletter featuring exciting and far-reaching members of our global diaspora. So, Adrian, I'd love to kind of pick up on maybe back to Fermanagh, but maybe not. I kind of lean on you a wee bit for this section, but would you have come from a farming background then, or how did you get into sheep farming?
My dad's from Letterbrain and my mum's from Florenscourt, and both of them came from farming families. Farming was in the blood on both sides of the house there. Dad worked in the court service, so we sort of travelled around Lisburn, Armagh, Enniskillen, and it probably wasn't until I was about 13 that we actually took over one of the family farms on my dad's side and he started doing part-time farming. And then my brother did full-time farming when he inherited the place. And so always been around farms, cattle, that sort of stuff.
I mean, it's mad to me to think that your father would be working in the courts and then doing the farming part time. Like that's such an interesting culture for me. And I guess that's something that you have carried forward yourself as well in some regards.
Yeah, it's wearing more than one hat at a time, you know? It's nice actually. You work in an office, you can do, Zoom calls, you can do your meetings, and then, at lunchtime you don tools and you go outside and pick up a shovel. And it's like a tonic, you know?
It's one way to clear the head anyway, isn't it? And you don't need to schedule your workout either. You just go do some actual work.
Just go do stuff, yeah. And there's always stuff to do on a farm, so there's no shortage of projects.
So would you have done a lot of chores and stuff on the farm when you were growing up?
I mean, I'll do the usual stuff as a kid. You're growing up, you're doing some sports, you're doing some clowning around with your friends, all that sort of stuff, and then fencing in the rain, which I remember driving rain all day long. I remember that sort of stuff, or whether it's chopping sticks, whatever. We put in a concrete lane into the house, when I was about probably 15 or 16, and that was a whole summer long project. So there's just stuff to do at a farm,
Yeah, absolutely.
so it was kind of
Absolutely.
fun, and just watching cattle being born, calves and that sort of stuff. It was a fully rounded education process.
So, I mean, speaking of education, then, how did you get into the world of consulting? Because, again, on paper, it's not an obvious fit. Fermanagh guy doing the part-time stuff on a farm to then getting into this quite flashy, glass office sort of environment.
Yeah, so it's like I kind of grew up in Fermanagh, in West Fermanagh, in Letterbrain, and it was a farm. There was a lot of rain, all that sort of stuff. I finished school and decided I wanted to get out of Northern Ireland for a bit. So I went to university over in Sheffield, and did an electronics degree. The guy who lived next door to us, next door in the farm, being a couple of hundred yards away. But I mean, the guy who lived next door was a guy called Jim Maguire, and he was a lecturer down in Dundalk, community college. So, and he lectured in electronics. So, as I was sort of growing up, he sort of like enamored me with the electronic angle. And so I picked electronic engineering. You know, either that or I was going to end up working for my brother on the farm, you know. So
yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, so I went to Sheffield, and then I came back to Jordanstown, actually, and did a microelectronic engineering course because I got kind of into the sort of, you know, silicon chip side of things, mm-hmm. and kind of wanted to be, at that stage, I wanted to be a designer for Intel. And, you know, got into that, graduated out of there, and Ford were doing the milk round where they, you know, go around universities and try and cream off the different graduates and stuff. So Ford came to Belfast, I attended there, and, you know, I kind of got kind of interested in what they were doing, to be honest. I did the interview and, you know, they hired me. So I went into Ford and worked in their sort of process control group, which was taking a look at sort of the automation on the plant. Actually, before that, to be honest, I went to France for a year. When I was in Jordanstown, they had an intern program where you could take like a year out type thing. Mm-hmm. And I got selected to go work with France Telecom. So I worked over there in their public key encryption group, which is their sort of cybersecurity thing, at one of their research centers. And that was like a lot of fun. We were working in Caen and Normandy. You know, it was kind of just, you know, enjoyable. You know,
you've got
good weather. and, you know, I got into surfing and got like a windsurfer, and we'd go like at lunchtime down to the beach and windsurf on the beaches. And it was just nice. And the work was really good too, because it was like, you know, public key encryption was at the time state-of-the-art type stuff. On the cybersecurity side. So that was that. And that's probably one of the things that the Ford guys were looking at when they hired me. So they were looking at that sort of experience and saying, hey, you know, we're going to have to make these cars secure. So, you know, you might have some experience that are useful for that. So I got hired into Ford, and that was kind of my experience into the corporate world.
It's lovely, kind of full circle, where, you know, you get picked up in the milk run by Ford, and then fast forward a few years and Ford's one of your clients. You know, that there's something so satisfying to that, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. Yeah. So it's you know, it is. It was kind of fun, you know, like working over in London. I worked there for about 3 years. You know, one of the things I got pretty involved in was inline vehicle sequencing, which is a bit of software that runs their production plants. And so I got involved in building and writing that code to build out that system. And there was another system for the engine plants called assembly management systems. And that sort of stuff is where you take like a mainframe computer bill for, you know, that you need to build so many cars per week, and you got to translate that down into, you know, an automated schedule for production plant, you know, all the little machines that run around. You had to translate that and make the whole plant work. And it was kind of fun. So I really did that for 3 years. It was kind of enjoyable.
So then how do you make another big jump then, or seemingly big jump, between, you know, working for Ford to then starting your own business, P Cubed?
Yeah, well, you're in London. I was actually, so they're based out in Essex. So And the plants are in like São Luís, Valencia, and Dagenham, and there was one in Bridgend, you know. So that it was enjoyable to work in that project to build the software and get it deployed. But, you know, living in Essex wasn't my dream place, you know.
That's one way to put it.
Yeah. So I kind of, you know, decided, and, you know, Ford was great, and the training was fantastic as well.
France ruined you, let's be honest.
It had, I needed good weather. but it was just time to do something different, you know. I mean, you know, you're getting flight listed, you're getting promoted at Ford, but, you know, did you really want to spend the next 30 years there? And the answer was no. So I basically quit and left. And I actually thought I was going to come back and do some farming. Because while I was at Ford, I'd saved up a bunch of money. I'd been riding a bicycle to work and that sort of stuff. And so I basically saved every penny I earned. And I bought a farm next door to my parents' place. I bought like a 60-acre farm or something like that. And I was thinking, okay, I could go back and do a bit of farming. You know, I've actually got my own place, you know. I wouldn't have to work for anyone else. Life would be good.
Yeah.
I went back in November, and it was really wet and windy and rainy and crappy. And I was like, oh man, I don't want to do this. so much for planning, right? So I, you know, I kind of just hang around for, you know, a month or two. And then I went and jumped on a plane to the US and figured, you know, I could do some consulting or try and do some sort of like, you know, advising stuff. And the only thing I really knew was the sort of Ford computer system stuff. But I figured that the guys in London wouldn't hire me back because I just quit and left. So I figured I'll go to the US and go to Detroit and see if I can get in there.
Nice.
And so I did. And I basically went to this guy called Brown, who actually was the bank manager in the Ulster Bank there in Enniskillen. And I went into him and basically tried to wangle my way to get like a car loan. So I got like a 10K car loan, or actually $10K. So I don't know what that was in sterling, but like 5 or 6K at the time or something like that. And had a bit of money in my pocket and then jumped on the plane and went over to Detroit, landed there and had enough money to survive for, you know, like a month or two. Mm-hmm. But essentially, you know, I was going into Ford and touting my wares and trying to say, you know, could you hire me as an independent, you know, contractor? Man. And they had a program called the Do 98, which was one of the Lincoln cars. And the guy in charge of that was a guy called Vince Fazio. And he took a shine to what I was saying. I can't remember exactly what I was saying anyway, but he took a shine to it and said, okay, come on in. You can help me do the program management of this particular vehicle line, which was, at the time, it was a multi-billion dollar vehicle. And I'm going like, here I am, a 26-year-old kid. And he's saying, you can help me program manage this car.
Epic.
And I was like, you know, so anyway, he said, yeah, can you bring in 6 people? And I was like, sure. and there you go.
Wow. Mate, that's yeah, that is absolutely mental. And so that's how P-Cube started.
Yeah, that's how it started.
Sick. What an origin story. So, I mean, there's so many things in that. The first thing that is at the top of my head is like, you know, yes, okay, London's a city and London's a big city, but there's a big difference between working in London and working in, you know, industrial Essex to moving to like the industrial belly of the United States that is Detroit. Like, what was the Rust Belt like?
Well, you know, I got on the plane, I was flying over to Detroit, and the first thing is I arrived in the middle of February. I think I arrived on like February 13th or something like that, or sometime in around there in 1993. And I didn't realize that planes could actually land on snow. Again, the runway was covered in snow. It was that cold. And I'd come over with my suit and my tie and my little anorak and all that sort of stuff. And I walked out and it was just, you know, it was like, it was like 20 degrees below zero. And I was like, oh, crap.
Crazy.
So it was pretty cold. But yeah, no, it was a different culture. You don't know anyone. You've got no relationships. You've got nothing to fall back on.
So then how the heck did you get your 6 people?
Yeah, just pick up the phone and start calling people. And initially I found a guy who was a guy called Kim Hamilton, who was down in Colorado, and he was working on decommissioning like a nuclear facility, which, you know, basically, if you're going to decommission a nuclear facility, you've got to do it right and do it very precisely. So he was really good at the project management stuff. So I hired him, brought him over and kind of learned a few things from him. And then I said, like, do you know anyone as well? Do you have a mate or something? And so, you know, we basically, network effect and kind of, you know, in the meantime, the client was saying, like, have you got your 6 people here? And I'm like, yeah, they're coming.
And you're like, okay, who do you know?
pretty much. But, you know, I got like a bunch of young guys that were really, energetic. They were, talented people, smart. And we came in there and we kind of kicked up a storm, you know, and we delivered, knocked the spots off the client. They were really impressed. It just, you know, you're working all the hours that God sends. You're up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you're going to bed at 10 o'clock at night, and you just work. And because those guys were from Colorado, they were also away from home. So they didn't have any, you know, network in the state either. So we could all work together and hang out together. And we just basically just focused on work. And, you know, within 4 or 5 years, we had 70 odd people working within four.
Madness. I mean, that is just, it's literally insane. And then, you know, as we mentioned at the top of the show, 20 years later, whenever you go to sell it, there's over 1,000 people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you were to, when you look back on that season of your life, you had had experience, but you didn't have a lot of, like, I don't know, leadership experience, for lack of a better term, I suppose. Like,
why, I had a clue.
Like, why do you, why do you think that that was successful? Or, like, you know, was there any kind of key elements there that, that made that not completely just collapse in on itself?
Yeah, well, it's you know, I think, you know, I just don't know. You know, I didn't know anything at all. Like, I've never had anyone work for me or anything like that. Mm. You know, I'd never sold anything in my life before. You know, it just kind of, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. You just kind of, you know, and the thing is, like, you know, if you're working in the corporate world, you know, just working really hard and delivering and getting the deliverables done, just, you know, leading from the front is kind of the way I would put it. You know, I actually believe you don't have to give people a lot of direction. Mm. You have to give people enough direction so that they understand the guardrails. Yeah. And they understand the objective. But, you know, you just let people innovate and they will, you'll, people will surprise you. You know, if people are motivated and they know their lanes, they will do a really good job, you know, if you get the right, if you get the right guy.
So what were the key motivators that you would put in place?
Really interesting work, number one. That allows you to hire really interesting people. Really interesting and talented people want to work on some interesting stuff. And then, you know, you kind of, you know, you kind of create a support system where you kind of get teachable points of view. So you're basically looking at how do I learn from the collective experience of the group and get that into someone's head when they come in the door, and just build those systems up. So you have talented people attract talented people. Mm-hmm. Talented people are attracted on doing really complex and interesting work. So you get a really high talent group of people. You figure out your templates, your systems, your processes, so to speak, and you turn that into a teachable point of view, so you can get that into someone's head pretty quickly, and then you get out of the way. You know, you don't overmanage. You know, so. You know, I never liked when people told me what to do, so
sure.
I'm not going to tell people what to do. I'm just going to say, there's the job, there's the templates, you know, go have at it.
Brilliant, mate, brilliant. So, you know, you sell up, I imagine you do well from it. Is there a temptation then to, you know, what was going through your head? Like, what was the temptation? It's like, okay, now I'm going to go back to farming. Or was it like, now I'm going to do this? Like, what were you thinking about doing?
Well, when I told my mum when I was leaving, I said, I'll be back in 3 years. I'm just going to go over, you know, do a bit of consulting, you know, try and get this thing going, and then I'll sell it and come back in 3 years' time. And no, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the first sort of couple of years we were in, you know, in Detroit and cranking up from there. And we set an office up in London and started to expand there. And then I flew out to San Francisco in probably 98. We set an office up over there. It was in the dot-com boom. So I was like, okay, well, we're doing auto stuff and we're doing some computer systems on auto, but this Silicon Valley stuff was pretty cool. So I flew out there and actually moved out there and kind of set the office up myself out there and kind of got a couple of clients like Cisco and Levi's were a client as well. Clorox and Fireman's Fund Insurance Company and a whole bunch of other things out in the valley. And we set an office up in LA. Because some of the guys had come from Colorado, we put an office into Colorado. Then I moved up to Seattle. I said, okay, well, they're Microsoft or a tech company, so they do tech stuff, so we need to set up a partnership with them. So, you know, I went up and met with a bunch of the guys up there, and, you know, we set up a partnership with Microsoft, and, you know, the next thing we knew in 3 or 4 years, we were their largest project management partner, worldwide.
Wow.
Yep.
Very, very cool. So what was it about Seattle that was sticky for you that brought you back?
Seattle is kind of like Fremantle's sun with bigger hills.
What a great way to sell it. I'm in.
I mean, it's got green grass. It's got, like, you got the rain in the wintertime. It's got the mizzly stuff in the wintertime. But come around sort of like May through October, the sun kicks open. It's 75 or 80 degrees pretty much most days. It's beautiful. You got mountains, and in the middle of it, you got like a bay, which is kind of like Sydney Harbour, if you've ever been there. So you got like this harbour bay type thing with all these boats on it. You got these mountains that go to like 10,000 feet just all around you, and the weather is just magic. So yeah, I was hooked, and the place was kind of cool too. Like, you know, it's a young city, it's dynamic. You know, people were in the 30s. You had a lot of tech companies there. It's actually the home for all the cloud software, you know, so like as Microsoft Azure or, you know, Amazon, AWS, they're all located in Seattle. So you've got just this energy and you've got this cool vibe, you know, coffee, you know, grunge music scene, that sort of stuff. So it was just a cool place to be, you know, so.
Very cool. So what did you do in between the gap between P-Cubed and starting in Vorso? How long was that window?
P-Cube got big, and you know that you know you make some mistakes along the way where you don't do everything perfect. So it got big and it got a bit messy. So I was like, ah, to hell with that, we're going to get rid of it. So sold it, and sold it pretty much within. I mean, from start to finish, it took about 9 months to get it done. And we completed that. And then I was like, okay, I'm retired now. I'm in my 40s. I'm done.
Yeah, you're like financially independent, retire early before it's cool. Let's do it.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I totally expected to retire, you know. And, you know, after about two or three months, I'm like, man, am I bored. So
what did you do in those 2 or 3 months? Like, what was your version of sipping Mai Tais on the beach?
Having cups of coffee, you know, going on holidays, you know, having the wife kick me out of the house, you know, things like that, you know? So, you know, and then I started playing old man rugby, you know, that over 40s game.
I like that, yeah.
Yeah, so that was a way to get out and do something totally different, because I'd been pretty much absorbed by work up until that point. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of nice just to get out and do something different. And it also, you know, I play wing or fullback or that sort of thing. And, you know, I'm about 5'9", you know, and 170 wet. So,
there you go. You know,
if I get hit, you know, then it hurts. So
yeah, you're like also the rugby version of a quarterback. You're like protecting at all costs. I'm the same.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, quarterbacks are valuable. I don't know if I'm that valuable or not, but it was basically, you know, fear, right? So if you're on a rugby field and you're going to get a hit, fear motivates you to run. And so I didn't want to get hit. So it forced me to go out there and do some running and and just get fit and healthy again, you know? So that was it for me. But then talking to the guys in the rugby community, there was like, you know, Where is rugby in the US? You know, you got professional soccer leagues, you got professional lacrosse leagues, like whatever, you know. It's like, but you don't have a professional rugby situation.
Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, we should have one, but we don't have one. So I got together there was probably about 9 other guys. We got a group of us together, and there were 9 people from 9 cities that were involved one way or another with the rugby community in the US. And we basically got together. We met in Houston, and then we met again in Denver. And we kind of just basically took a copy of the MLS operating agreement, copied it, changed the title, and threw it down and said, okay, we'll create this league. And we've done our research a little bit, but not, again, you know, with both things I've done, I haven't really done that much planning. You just get in there and go for it. Mm-hmm. So we got it together, and then everyone had to cough up some money. And that's when a couple of guys dropped out.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
So we coughed up the money to fund the central office. And then we had to set up our own individual teams. You had to cough up more money to stand up our own team. So of the 9 cities that started out, we ended up with 7.
That's pretty good going, like, in all fairness.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it was pretty good. And they're a great bunch of guys, and you know, there's a good bit of camaraderie there. But you know, obviously, when you started putting the teams together, the camaraderie goes out the window.
I was going to say, like, how does that work in a rivalry like situation? Cutthroat very quickly. The teeth come out.
Yeah, it's all like you're working on your logos. You're working on, you know, the marketing thing. You're working
on website has to be better than their website.
Yeah, exactly. All that stuff. Well, we do a central thing, so we kind of pool central resources. So it's not like every team has their own separate functions. A lot of those are centralized in the middle. So when we were centralizing things in the middle, it was really collaborative and it was great, and wonderful.
Yeah,
and it still is, you know. But you know, when you go back to your teams, you know, you're like, it comes around Saturday and we're going to win.
exactly. And just on that point, like, I do quite like, you know, on the Seattle Seawolves website, at the very top of the page, there's all the other teams' logos. So there is that kind of, you know, rolling each other up as well. It was just a small little detail. I was like, I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, it is. It's good, and you can jump to the other teams' websites and stuff like that. So, you know, it is a really collaborative style of playing. But we set it up as a private independent company, so it's not run by the rugby union or anything. It's an independent company that's owned by the teams. And we've got a sanctioning agreement with US Rugby, but it's fully independent. So, you know, I sit on the board of governors and we make our own rules and regulations and we go for it.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and then, you know, with Seattle, we put the team together. I worked with a couple of guys in Seattle that were pretty ingrained into the rugby community there, a guy called Kevin Flynn in particular. And we pull a team together. We go out there. We spend the first season in 2018. And, you know, we're underdogs the whole way through it. But we ended up losing two games in the whole season. We came in second in the league. And then one plays two in the final. And we win the final.
Epic.
So that was cool.
Very cool. Well, I mean, what have been some of the highlights or the challenges of, number one, setting up your own rugby league, and then number two, with a team, you know?
Where to start? Setting up a professional sports league is bloody hard. I don't know if I would have done it, knowing what I know now. But it's really hard. It's a lot of hard work because you're really trying to get. You can't do it on your own. You know, like when I set up Invorso, or when I set up P-Cubed, or when I set up any of the other companies I've set up, it's normally I'm doing it on my own and I can get it done.
Yeah.
You know, you can argue with yourself, but at the end of the day, you just got to get on with it.
Sure.
Whereas when you're setting up a professional sports league, you need a lot of capital, number one. You need a lot of people you need people to lead each of the different cities because you can't be in more than one place at one time. And each of those teams needs to build out a base of investors. So that they have sustainable models going forward. So you're dealing with a lot of people, and you're dealing with a lot of people who have been successful in life. So it's not like I was hiring, you know, 20-year-old, 30-year-old consultants. I was dealing with people who were very successful in their own right. And so they've all got their egos and all that sort of stuff. So it's a slightly different way to work, but you're trying to collaborate and build a collective that is bigger than yourself. And you're really saying, okay, if we do this right, this will have legs long after we're dead and gone. You know, so it's leaving behind something that is important, and that was kind of what motivated me on that one.
Absolutely. And how are you guys getting on, or how are you guys making it work in terms of the finances? Because from a outsider perspective, you know, in terms of even sponsorship alone, the United States seems to have a different culture around all that sort of stuff.
Well, rugby in the United States is different than back home. Like back home, everyone knows what rugby is. You know, Enniskillen's got a club. You know, everywhere, there's clubs all over the place. There's good relationships between GAA and rugby. You know, they share pitches and all that sort of stuff. And you know, it's been on TV. There's a national team over in the US. No one knows what it is. Yeah, so there's all that sort of like. You think about it, all that culture that's built up over 150 years of rugby back home, none of that exists. So like, you know, even something as simple as shaking hands coming off a field, that doesn't happen in US sports.
Wow.
Going for a meal afterwards, that doesn't happen. You know, so you're really having to sell the culture, and then you're trying to get US athletes bought into the culture, promote that in a way that they get visibility, and they become stars in their own right. And you know, that's a, so you're, it's not, you know, the way, it's not just setting up a league. You're having to start from ground zero. There's no infrastructure.
Yeah. You, like you said, you're setting up a culture really, or establishing a culture. Wow.
And so that, cause none of that exists over here. So you're building that from ground zero, getting people bought into it. And it's all about hearts and minds and getting things shifted in the right direction. And as you know, that, you know, nothing goes in a linear direction when you set something up. It always goes zigzag, right? No one can say, I'm starting point A and I'm going to go to point B and it's a straight line. So you're zigzagging all over the place to make sure you get the right people involved, that they in turn are getting the right people that they know involved. You're building up a fan base as well. So like one of the things that, you know, I'm probably most proud about is in Seattle, We play to packed stadiums, like it's jam packed.
So,
you know, with 5,000 people at each of our home games when we're like people in the doors, you know. So, you know, building that culture up and getting the stadium full, and then being able to win on the field. And we won in 2018 and then we won in 2019 again, just for good measure. just to rub it in, I guess. and then, you know, you're then working to, with the other team owners to build out their base as well and share that, you know, this is what we do in marketing. What do you do in marketing? This is what we do in ticket sales and all that sort of good stuff, you know?
Yeah. So what a great opportunity as well to bring in Rory Best now as well. It's so good.
Yeah, well, it sort of started out as basically, you know, amateur. Like for 2018 was basically amateur-ish. And then 2019, it got into, you know, more professional. You know, like you had some branded players coming over, like big name players starting to leak into each some of the teams. And then in 2020, you had much more branded players coming in, and then you had some good coaches coming over from Australia and New Zealand and stuff. And then 2020 got cut short after about four games. You know, we pretty much, by about March 12th, we could smell that this thing was going to be here. The COVID thing was going to, you know, so there was no point in trying to fight it, or it's like just shut the thing down. And unlike most professional leagues in sports, we actually said we're going to pay our players out fully on their contracts.
Epic.
So we didn't cut the players' salaries; we just paid them out. And we thought that would buy us some goodwill with the players, so that when we started back up again in 2021, that there'd be, you know, there'd be some residual goodwill there versus, you know, if we just, you know, cut their checks by 2/3 and said off you go home, you know. So that helped us get through. And then, you know, the 2020 season was cut short, no revenue coming in, you're paying all the money out, so you have to build out your investor base. And yeah, I think each of the teams have their own little journey on that one. But thankfully all the teams came through, survived. And then when we kicked off in 2021, it was no longer amateur plus, it was full on professional.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So it's really, you know, and you had like, you know, Rob Shaw coming over, you know, you got, you just got a lot of players of international quality on the ground over here. And to a certain extent, we got kind of short circuited. You know, I was kind of still thinking on the amateur plus level. And some of the other teams had said, well, we need to beat these guys, therefore we're going to go full pro.
You're right. Whoa, I didn't know we were doing that. Okay.
Yeah. It's like, come on, that's not fair.
Sneaky.
But I get it. You know, it's competitive. Everyone wants to win. So, exactly. And so we kind of readjusted and shuffled a bit and got on the phone, worked it. We got some more players in and we got some more that are coming in. And, we had a couple of injuries early on this season, which is, you know, a part of the reason for the results, but also just getting Clarkey and Best in and involved in the setup gives us, you know, world-class level and coaching, which I think is really important for the players because America's got tremendous athletes, right? They're big, they're fast, they're physical, they've got a great work ethic, you know, and they're like sponges ready to learn. So if you don't, you know, so I figured, okay, we'll build out our Seattle base of players, use local talent if we can, but we need to coach them really well. So that's kind of one of the things we're doing. And looking at some crossover athletes, like the one of the Seattle Seahawks players, a guy called Luke Wilson, we're involving him in the setup this year. Nice. You know, and, you know, fantastic athlete. You know, so just need to get that rugby IQ up so we can play. You know, and that's where just good coaching comes in.
Yeah,
so,
totally.
Give
us your Invorso origin story then. You know, so you finished. You're like finally out of the consultant world. You're like, great. This is, you know, I'm doing all this other stuff. And then what on earth brings you back in? And how did that start?
Well, yeah. So I'm doing the sports thing, and on the side, I was also doing a little bit of venture capital stuff. So working with some of the VC firms and kind of helping out where I can, doing a little bit of, you know, investing myself on some database technology. And just, you know, because that's kind of what I've been doing for a very long time, working in the tech world. So it's kind of nice just to keep your hand in it, but not be dictated by it, if that makes
sense. Yes, absolutely.
Any sense? So my schedule wasn't dictated by what I was doing. I could kind of go in and out and dabble in it as I wanted. So that was kind of cool. But you know, I'd worked originally in Ford, and I got to know the tech stuff, and then, you know, from my days in Silicon Valley, etc. And, you know, you have this thing called self-driving cars and Tesla coming along, right? And it's the perfect combination of here's the industrial giants, and here's some smart tech that's basically going to turn cars into robots. I mean, who would have thought the first robots in the world were going to be your car?
Mental.
You know? And I was like, that's just too good an opportunity to miss. I want to be part of that. That's where it came from. And I was like, I just got to be part of that. That just sounds like too interesting. I understand the challenges, and there's a lot of them, but that was just far too interesting. So I just, you know, set a company up, started, you know, got a team together, started working on it. We hired a bunch of really smart tech guys, and we brought on board some very, very smart industrial guys. The CEO of the firm is a guy called Scott Tobin, who was Mr. Lincoln, so he ran the Lincoln Car Company.
Wow.
You know, I've got, you know, a couple of guys that were corporate vice presidents at Microsoft, GM, things like that. So bringing that talent together and then addressing it into the electric vehicle world, whether it's the fueling stations, it's the adaptive driving systems, or it's the app development cloud software, the embedded system within the vehicle, it gets really complicated really quickly. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you've got basically customer experiences that then drive how that software should look, and then that software itself then drives the compute platform that's in the car, because the compute platform is limited in the power that it has, because it's, you know, it drives around the roads, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of how I got involved in that.
Very cool. And talk to me about the Belfast office.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, I mean, I you know, part of it is giving back, you know, setting up an office in Belfast. You know, primarily we got these clients in the US, that are, you know, you got Rivian, Canoe, Ford, you got a bunch of EV companies, you got some big OEMs, and they're doing really challenging work. And the guys that I grew up with back home and went to university with were all really smart. But the issue is there's not much opportunity. Like, where do you go to work? Like,
sure.
You know, I mean, half my, like, well, yeah, I don't care, but like half the class goes to like Bombardier or, you know, I mean, you know, and, you know, they just make planes or missiles that blow people up. And who wants to do that? So,
absolutely.
You know, there's not, you know, from my historical experiences, there wasn't a ton of opportunity to go work in, you know, in tech startup type world. So what I'm looking at is basically bringing really smart people into the company and then applying them to some of these big American projects.
Very, very cool.
And with the world of remote working, you know, you could do it from Belfast.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, I mean we've got guys in London that are working on clients in LA, you know, so.
And what is keeping you personally interested in the Invorso journey at this stage?
Well, it's you know, people think that the problems have been solved, but they're a long way from being solved. You know, so I think all the car companies have made a massive bet. And so by 2025, 2026, you're going to start seeing a whole bunch of more than just Teslas. You're going to see a whole bunch of electric vehicles hit the road. And that's going to put a whole bunch of challenges on the infrastructure, like, you know, charging infrastructure. Is the electricity there to charge that many cars? You know, you've got like petrol stations, you know. You know, petrol stations have got like four pumps, and cars fill up in like 3 minutes or something like that. With EVs, it's going to take 30 minutes. Wow. So you're going to need more stations. You're going to need more parking infrastructure. What are the people going to do when they're hanging around, you know, for 30 minutes? Like, you know, they're not going to just stand there and, you know, look at a candy counter. They've got to do stuff. So the infrastructure around EVs is challenging, and that's going to challenge governmental policy as well as everything else. The number of EV companies, there's 66 companies that I know of in the EV space that are racing to produce cars. They're going to run headlong into the big OEMs in the world, the Toyotas, the Fords, the GMs of the world. And there's going to be a battle as to who produces the best cars and who wins. Ford produced the Mustang as their first electric vehicle out of the gate, and it's got, you know, acceleration times the same as Tesla. So you're gonna have, it's gonna be a big fist fight, and it's gonna happen around 25, 26, and it'll keep going till around 32. Then there'll be, you know, consolidation where different companies are gonna make it, some are not gonna make it. If you look in the US, you've got these SPACs, which are, you know, basically funding vehicles that are turning companies that were nothing yesterday into multi-billion-dollar, you know, public companies at the minute. We're working with a bunch of those guys, and it's exciting stuff. And producing a car is hard. You know, you just don't, you know, you get a bunch of money, you get some, you know, concepts for an electric vehicle, you get a battery pack, off you go. Well, you can produce a car, you know, by hand, one or two a day, and that's not too difficult. But when you take a look at mass production, so like the F-150, I mean, Ford kick off an F-150 every 46 seconds.
My
So producing stuff at speed is really difficult, and to make it reliable and ensure it works all the time, and that the software gives you an experience that makes you want to come back and buy more, it's complicated stuff. So that juices me up, and I'm pretty excited about that. That journey of the next sort of 5 or 6 years.
Great answer, man. Really great answer. Yeah. Well, quick little random one before we move into the stock questions, just the end of the interview. Why is Cloud Atlas your favorite book?
Cloud Atlas. I mean, because it basically goes about, it's about different people in different situations, and it's about the good and the bad that are with people. And it's that people dynamic within the book that actually I like a lot. Yeah.
Fascinating. So, series of questions we ask every guest just kind of before we end every episode. First one, the first two are quite big questions. Biggest challenge along the way, and how were you able to overcome it?
Biggest challenge was being 26, 27, living in Detroit, not knowing anybody, with staring down at, you know, failure, because you can't deliver something, and then trying to figure out how you assemble a team and make that happen. That was the biggest challenge. And you then have the financial challenge of making payroll. And then you're in a different country, so you got all the regulatory and rules and accounting stuff, and you don't have a clue. So that challenge was, it was scary. So that was the biggest challenge.
Absolutely. What about the flip side then? What about your most proudest moment?
Picking up the title on 2018 when we won the championship.
Why Seawolves?
Seawolves. Well, you got Seahawks, so why not?
Yeah. There it is. Simple as that.
You know, and it's basically what Seawolves is basically orcas, right? So there's a big Native American community in the Pacific Northwest. And the Native Americans call the orcas, you know, killer whales. They call those the wolves of the sea.
Oh, that's
so badass. We kind of figured we'll just do that.
Wow.
So, but and the logo, I mean, it cost $500. It was designed on the back of a piece of paper. And it was essentially, take a look at the Seahawks logo, convert that over to a fish, and off you go.
Bob's your uncle, you're flying.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Yep.
If you could take anyone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, out for a cup of coffee or a pint, who would you take? Where would you take them and why?
That'll have to be Rory Best. And take it. And I have, and I will. reason why, like, you know, he's not the biggest hooker in the world, but he fought his way through the different teams to become one of the most effective hookers. And he then took being a very good player onto being a very talented leader, and leading at the highest level and then beating the All Blacks twice. That would be the guy I'd take out for a cup of coffee.
And he's a good farming lad as well. It always helps.
He does. He's got a good Aberdeen Angus herd there. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Adrian, final question then. Question we always end with, and it's just very simply: if you could, edit it slightly for yourself. If you could have a few minutes of 26-year-old Adrian's time, let's say on the plane to Detroit, you know, you're able to somehow, you know, pass by and sit down and have a cup of tea with yourself. What sort of things would you say to that younger version of yourself?
I'd say slow down and plan ahead. I just basically jumped into things, not knowing what I was jumping into. And then I figured it out as I went. Doing a little bit more upfront thinking would have helped.
Yeah, if the blind leads the blind, both shall fall into a ditch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's one of my favorites from the Bible, actually. Yeah.
Oh, there you go. So yeah, look, thank you so much for listening over the last 1 hour. Thank you so much for hanging out with myself and Adrian. Really hope you enjoyed today's episode. I really, really found it fascinating just diving into all the different little pockets of Adrian's story. For more stories just like this, you can head to niconnections.com, where you can check out more people from Northern Ireland that live overseas. They're doing really interesting things. You can also check out bestofbelfast.org for over 200 episodes just like this one. And other than that, Adrian, just got to say thank you so much for giving your time up to do this, and I really, really enjoyed it, so thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks for the opportunity.